while we waited. Grandpa paced the floor. The whole time she was washing up, he stopped walking only long enough to hitch up his trousers and scratch his head, like if he scratched hard enough and fast enough, he might think how to get his way. We finally heard Miss Love pour her dirty water out of the washbowl into the waste pot on the floor, but it was some time before she knocked and said she was through. Grandpa rushed open the door, and it was like he'd opened onto a flower garden. Miss Love had on so much perfume. She stood there in the doorway, holding the red hat in her hand and her clothes draped over one arm. The white gown peeped out above and below her coat, which she was using like a robe. In the soft lamplight, she looked real pretty. Her freckled face was flushed, her eyes bright in the frame of dark lashes, her hair plaited into a thick, shiny braid that hung down the left side of her neck. "I'm sorry it took me so long," she said, her voice steady. Grandpa surprised me by leaning over and kissing her on the cheek. "Good night," he said. For a long moment they stood there staring at one another, like his eyes were steel and hers a dern magnet. Her lips trembled. There being no way to get past them, I just sat there on the cot, half asleep, watching them block the doorway. Finally, Grandpa took a deep breath, which shook a little as he let it out. "I know you plumb wore out, Miss Love."
"No, not really. I feel fine. I feel fine. Are you very tired?"
"Gosh almighty, no. If I was a bull, I could bust through a fence right now and never feel it."
He touched her arm. She didn't move away. He laughed softly.
"But I reckon I won't be a-doing that tonight. Well, Miss Love, sleep good, yeah? Call me if you need anything."
They were still staring at one another.
"Be sure and call me if there's anything I can—"
"Thank you, I won't need anything, Mr. Blakesley. Good night, sir."
She moved past him into the little room. I reckon she'd forgot all about me because it startled her when I got up from the cot.
Good night, Will."
"Good night, ma'am." She patted my arm as I went out. Then she shut the door. Grandpa walked over to the washstand and poured some water into the big flowery bowl, but I just pulled off down to my union suit and turned back the covers. I was too tired to care about road dust.
"Which side do you want to sleep on, Grandpa, left or right?"
"It don't matter, son. Like I used to tell your granny, ever which side I'm on is the right side. She always said hers was the one next to the cradle or closest to the kitchen."
I was standing on the side by the door to Miss Love's room, so I just got in there. The wall between my head and hers was only one thin board, and I soon realized it might as well not be there. I heard her pull up the quilt. I heard her turn over. I heard her sigh. I must have dropped right off to sleep. I didn't know when Grandpa came to bed, but I knew when he got up. The coil springs squeaked and waked me. I thought he just needed to use the pot, which he did, but then he moved around the bed. Every time a board creaked underfoot, he stopped and looked over at me. It wasn't like Grandpa to notice or care if he was disturbing somebody. Plain as day, he didn't want me to wake up, so I didn't, not for him to know it. But I watched as he tiptoed over to the window where he'd laid his clothes on a chair and, standing in a long slanting rectangle of moonlight, put on his pants over his union suit and pulled up the suspenders. Instead of knocking on Miss Love's door, he opened it quiet as a burglar. I heard her gasp. He whispered, "Shh, it's me. I'm a-coming in." There wasn't any question mark in his voice, but she whispered,
Well, all right.
And I heard her get up. Grandpa closed the door, but it didn't any more shut me out than if I was a ghost. I doubt they were standing more than 2 feet from my head when he grabbed her.
"Oh, Lord, Miss Love, you don't know how long I've been a-waiting to hold you like this."
His voice was muffled, as if his face was buried in her neck.
"Seems like all my life."
She laughed kind of nervous and whispered in a teasing way,
"Now, Mr. Blakesley, that's no way to talk to a housekeeper."
"I ain't a-talking to no dang housekeeper, Miss Love. I'm a-talking to my wife."
Still teasing and I guess holding him off, she whispered, "I won't be the wife of anybody who calls me Miss, and I have to call him Mister. So, Mr. Blakesley, go back to bed."
He whispered right back, "If and Miss and Mister is all that's coming betwixt us, I sure wished you'd have said so in New York City. Your name's Love? Ain't no problem. My name's Rucker. Pleased to meet you."
And then before she could say pea turkey, he grabbed her again. This time, if my ears heard right, she grabbed him too. After a while, she whispered,
"Oh, dear God, what are we going to do?"
I reckon Grandpa found her mouth before God could answer, because for the longest time the only sounds I heard were little moans and gasps and Grandpa's hard breathing. He sounded like it was all uphill in there. Miss Love must have pulled away, to judge by her voice, as she whispered, "Please, Mr. Blakesley, if you knew—" And then she went to crying.
"Hesh now, shh, shh, shh. Ain't nothing to cry about, Miss Love, lessen you don't love me, which if you said it I wouldn't believe you. Love, love, oh, love, it ain't hard at all to call you love, or to say you're beautiful or how sweet you smell. You're like Miss Mattie Lou's rose garden, love." They kissed again. "You're shivering," he said. "I could warm you up."
"I'm not cold. Don't, Mr. Blakesley, you'll tear Miss Gussie's gown."
His whispered voice was hoarse.
"Good God in heaven."
I thought he was about to say it's time to pray, but for what seemed like an hour or two, all I heard was them breathing and kissing. I won't try to say what I was feeling all that time.
"What are you doing? Don't—"
she said all of a sudden, alarmed. "I'm just loosening your braid. I ain't never seen your hair down, love. I want to feel it. I want to feel it on my face."
"Please go back to bed, sir. The boy might hear us."
He groaned. "I ain't studying him. He's dead asleep anyhow. Listen to him."
Like I was in cahoots with Grandpa, I snored softly. I couldn't stand the embarrassment if they knew I was awake. They were silent a minute, then she whispered,
"There's so much you don't know."
Smack. "Then say it, love, but make haste. I've been a-waiting for you a million years. I can't wait no longer."
I was shocked, and she must have felt the same.
But I only agreed to be your housekeeper."
Her whisper rose in pitch, an angry sound.
"I will not be taken advantage of, Mr. Blakesley. How dare you try to use me like I'm a—why, I trusted you."
"I love you, Miss Love. Can't you see that? And today it seemed like you loved me, too."
"What are you saying, Mr. Blakesley?"
"You deaf? I'm saying I love you, dang it. I'm saying I want you to be my wife. I'm saying I've been a-waiting to hold you in my arms ever since the day we got married. No way longer than that, Lord help me. Miss Love, love, I've been a-waiting for this minute ever since the day I laid eyes on you."
It made me sick hearing that.
"Please, Mr. Blakesley, you don't know what you're saying."
Her words were more softly spoken than whispered, and I could tell she had moved away from him, nearer the door.
"I don't believe. You never made one gesture, sir. Never said one word."
"No, but every time I looked at you, I thought it. God help me, I've been loving you and hating myself every time I—"
"You never did anything wrong," she protested, like she wanted to take up for him.
Then she lowered her voice again.
"I never once suspected. That's why I was so shocked when you asked me to marry you. I didn't think you'd even noticed me, Mr. Blakesley."
"I was scared to notice you. Scared somebody would notice me noticing. Scared Miss Mattie Lou might, and I wouldn't have hurt her."
I heard him sink heavily onto the cot, and he must have bent his head down, to judge by his voice.
"Miss Mattie Lou knowed something was eating up my soul, Miss Love. She kept a-saying, 'Mr. Blakesley, tell me what's worrying you so.' And when she took sick—"
"Shh, you're talking too loud, sir. Please don't wake up, Will. Go on back to bed now, and we'll talk when—"
"I got to talk now," he said, but minding her and dropping his voice to a whisper. "By the time we get home, I might have lost my nerve. I used to beg God to take away my craving for you. When I'd get up off my knees, I'd feel better. But then the very next day, I'd watch you working at your table, and I couldn't hardly stand it, you were so beautiful. Then Miss Mattie Lou took sick, and I got scared the Lord might take her to punish me for my sin. I ain't never believed God was that mean. But what if and he was? I commenced begging for forgiveness. When she was so sick, I got the notion if I didn't go down to the store where I'd see you, I could get you out of my system. Miss Mattie Lou was— she married me when I want nothing, Miss Love. She give me all she had when her daddy died, and she ruined her health having babies that didn't live, trying to get me a son to carry on the name.
She knowed how much.
His voice broke.
She would have tried again, but the doc said another baby'd kill her. So I made sure that didn't happen. I loved Miss Matty Lou very much. You understand that?
I could hear tears in her voice as she whispered, "Yes, yes, of course I do."
She was part of me. I could tell her anything. Except about you, of course. It was just like with Will Tweedy and now you. I can cut the fool with anybody, but there ain't many folks I can really talk to. Well, after what Doc said, I stayed off from her.
Mr. Blakesley, it's not right to tell me all this.
I got to tell somebody. You rather I tell Will Tweedy, or Mary Willis, or Loma? I'm saying I stayed off from her. And after a while, the fire went out. Seemed like she was just my sister, my friend, not my wife. It was like all the feelings I ever felt, a man for a woman, I mean, they was just dead. Then I went to the depot to get you when you come in on that train from Baltimore, Miss Love. I took one look at you, so young and feisty, and hankered after you like a schoolboy.
Hush, sir, hush.
You don't know what I've been through these 2 years, Miss Love. Lord, I wished we didn't have to whisper. I'm a-gettin' hoarse.
Go back to bed, Mr. Blakesley. We'll talk later.
It was like she was speaking to a child. He paid no attention.
After you left off living at our house and went to the Crabtrees, Miss Love, I couldn't wait to get to the store every morning. If and I was sick, I went on anyways. I thought I'd die when a whole day went by and I didn't get to see you. Often as I dared to, I'd tell Miss Matty Lou, set a place for the milliner at Sunday dinner here. She's kind of homesick. Or she don't get good cooking at Miss Crabtree's, not like yourn. You and me and her, we'd have such a good time round that pie-anna after dinner. It kind of eased my guilty feelings, seeing how fond of you she was. But then, by George, you commenced keeping company with that fool son, Black. I couldn't hardly stand it.
He didn't mean a thing to me. He was just...
How was I to know? And then Miss Matty Lou was a-dying. I sat there by her in that rocking chair day after day, loving her and grieving. But in the backside of my mind, I was wondering if you might up and marry that son of a gun just when it looked like...
Shh! Don't say it, Mr. Blakesley. Please, let's stop talking. The boy...
I coughed and coughed again like in my sleep, and then snorted and turned over.
It'd have taken an earthquake to wake him up tonight.
There was a pause.
Your skin, it's so soft, love. See, it ain't hard at all to call you love. Your cheek, love, it's like...
He laughed.
Like a mule's nose, like velvet.
She laughed, too. He kissed her gently. I know it was gently because it didn't smack.
Love, when I sat there with Miss Matty Lou, I wasn't just begging God's forgiveness. I was praying she'd get well, but I was...
There's nothing wrong with that, Mr. Blakesley. God wants us to ask for his healing hand on...
Let me finish. God didn't want nobody to ask like I'd done. Gosh almighty, Miss Love, all the time I was praying him to spare Miss Matty Lou like he was a dang Santa Claus, I was thinking that if and she died, I could marry you.
I swear I saw the ghost of Granny flit distraught around the room. I wanted to sick her on him, shout, "He ain't in here, Granny, he's in yonder with her, go haint him." Soon as I thought it, I hoped she wouldn't. Back when she was alive and him lusting in his heart after another woman, it's a wonder God hadn't strung Grandpa up by his heels and split him down the middle. But I couldn't hate him now. And I hoped Granny up in heaven didn't hate him, and I hoped Miss Love wouldn't. If a man's been horsewhipping himself for 2 years, it seemed to me like not even God would want to punish him any more. I couldn't hear everything they said that night, especially when they moved away from the door. I missed words and even sentences when occasionally I breathed deep or snored a little so they wouldn't guess I was awake, but I heard most of it. After Grandpa's confession, Miss Love had tears in her voice.
"You poor dear man. I'm so sorry, so very sorry."
She whispered it over and over and then begged him to go back to bed. But Grandpa said he wasn't done talking.
"Miss Matty Lou's last few days,
Well, the good Lord finally set me free of you, Miss Love. My mind and heart was all on her. I knowed she was going to die, and all I wanted was for her to live. I kept thinking back over the years and knowed they was good years. I kept thinking how we used to talk in bed at night, how I was going to miss that, how I already missed it. He took a long breath. But, Miss Love, all such didn't last past the funeral. After I wrote down her dying in the Bible, I turned around and seen you standing there watching me. And from then on...
Oh, Mr. Blakesley, as God is my witness, I never guessed it, never encouraged...
I know that. I just wish you had encouraged me. Then I could have risked waiting a proper time to start courting you. As it was, I was twixt the rock and the hard place, afeard somebody else would get you in the meantime. That fool's son Black, for instance.
I would never have married him.
Well, I didn't know if you would or you wouldn't. On the other hand, if and I proposed right off, you'd think I was a dirty old man or that Miss Mattie Lou hadn't meant nothing to me. You wouldn't have no respect for me.
He sighed like he was lost in thought. Finally, he said, I commenced going by the cemetery every night after I left the store, Miss Love.
I know, I heard.
He laughed, soft and kind of rueful.
It wa'n't with me like that poor Miss Ernestine Tip Lady. You never knowed her. Miss Ernestine would go to the cemetery every evening to see old Mutt. That's what she called her husband. She'd tell him how she was feeling and all, and any news she'd heard, and when she left she'd blow him a kiss and say, "Good night, Mutt." Folks seen her do it. Then after a while Miss Ernestine got to saying good night to everybody else in the graveyard, calling them all by name. Poor thing finally commenced passing the time of day with them. Couldn't get home to fix supper for talking to dead folks.
He paused.
What I'm saying, I didn't go to the cemetery to talk to Miss Mattie Lou, but seemed like being there calmed me down some.
He coughed.
Gosh almighty, Miss Love, it's getting cold, and my throat's wore out from this here whispering. Will Tweedy's asleep, and if and he ain't, well, I ain't studying Will Tweedy right now.
At the cemetery, he said, he did wonder sometimes what Miss Mattie Lou would tell him to do if she could talk.
Late one night, I was so tired, Miss Love, I just laid down on the cool, fresh dirt, right on her grave. It felt like when we used to lay in bed together talking.
I reckon you think I was off in the head.
No, no, I understand.
Well, anyhow, it come to me something Miss Mattie Lou said long time ago, back when Mary Willis was on the way. She said, Mr. Blakesley, if God takes me in childbed... I remember trying to hush her up, but she had it on her mind. She said, if and I pass, I hope I done made living with a woman so sweet that, well, find you another wife and I'll take it as a compliment.
Miss Love started to speak, but he went on, talking low.
That sure made it easier to think on marrying you, Miss Love. It was like she'd give me her blessing. And whilst I was still a-laying over her in the dark night, I remembered something else she said one time. If and the Lord calls me first, Mr. Blakesley, don't be too stingy to hire you a colored woman. I can't rest easy up there if you down here wearing dirty clothes and nobody to see after you. That's what gave me the idea to ask you to be my housekeeper.
He didn't say anything for a minute, or her either. I reckon they were kissing. Then he went on,
I figured if and I could just get you sewed up, I could do the courting later. But I knowed I'd have to make it worth your while, me being old and all the talk and scandal of it. Took me about 2 minutes to decide you'd go against age and custom both for something big as a house.
She giggled, a little self-conscious.
I think I'd have done it for the piano.
The piano cinched it. Then 2 days later, here come Mr. Texas. It like to kilt me, seeing you were still in love with him.
I heard Grandpa get up from the cot and start pacing the floor. When he stopped, he breathed a long sigh that trembled in the night air.
Stealing Mary Willis's trip to New York City was a selfish thing I done.
Miss Love plain admitted that it was her fault.
I thought Mary Willis had definitely decided not to go. I...
Lord help me. When I seen you wanted to go so bad, all I could think was up there in New York I'd have you to myself, with nobody around to cast looks. And maybe...
I'm beginning to hate myself, Mr. Blakesley.
For marrying me?
For not guessing how you felt about me. I never even suspected it till we got to New York.
I didn't know you caught on then, Miss Love.
I didn't want you to know it.
You might near as good an actress as Loma. I thought I just lost the hang of courtin'.
She didn't answer that.
Mr. Blakesley, if you'd said you loved me when you proposed, I wouldn't have married you. I had decided never to marry, for reasons I can't speak of, for reasons no man would want to marry me. But you said...
There can't be no reason any man wouldn't be proud to marry you, Miss Love.
But you said you just wanted a housekeeper, Mr. Blakesley. You don't know how I had longed for, prayed for, what you offered. A home, and to belong to a good, decent family. It was as if God had finally figured out a way to give it to me.
It wasn't God figured it out, love. It was me. And now I'm asking you to be my wife.
When she didn't answer, he said, You can't say you don't care for me.
Of course I care for you, sir, but not like that. I'm sorry.
That ain't what your arm said or your lips said when I was a-kissing you.
I got carried away.
Ain't getting carried away part of what loving is?
You don't understand.
She spoke stiff and formal.
Loving, being a wife, that door is closed to me. After Mr. McAllister, I promised God.
There was an awful silence. Then Grandpa exploded.
Promised God or promised yourself? Gosh almighty, woman, God don't ask for no such a promise.
It was the only way I could find peace. And now I don't want to talk about it anymore. I'm tired. Mr. Blakesley, please go to bed.
What you and somebody else done, love, that's over with now. Same as my life with Miss Mattaloo is over with. That hand I ain't got no more. Ever what you done can't be no worse than me loving you whilst I sat by her deathbed. But ain't no point in me giving you up now that she can't get hurt. Ain't no point in you messing up what you and me could have just 'cause you and that dang Mr. Texas.
It wasn't him.
Her whisper was so weak I barely heard.
But don't ask me to talk about it. Clayt couldn't take the knowledge. You couldn't either.
You told him what you won't tell me?
Yes, I thought...
She sounded about to cry.
I thought I shouldn't have any secrets from the man I was about to marry. I thought if Clayt really loved me... How stupid I was.
I wondered if she meant stupid to tell him or stupid to think he wouldn't mind.
He'd thought I was so pure, not like the others. You understand, pure, Mr. Blakesley? Undefiled?
Silence.
Defiled can't be the right word for you, love. Or don't them Methodist preachers talk none about a forgiven God? Ain't you heard how Jesus said go and sin no more? He didn't say go waller in your sin.
I hadn't sinned.
Silence.
Miss Love, you don't make no sense at all, not to me. If you ain't sinned, how come all this here talk about you ain't pure no more?
Shh, you're talking loud, Mr. Blakesley.
And she lowered her own voice.
I can only say that Clayt, right after I told Mr. McAllister, he talked just like you, said it didn't matter. But, well, as you know, he finally broke the engagement. And you'd want to get out of being married to me too, Mr. Blakesley, if I told you.
Then, gosh almighty, woman, don't tell me. I don't give a good doggone, and I don't want to hear about it. I just want you to be my wife.
No, no, please. Please, Mr. Blakesley, don't touch me. Go back to bed, please.
I snored softly as I heard Grandpa's hand on the doorknob. I heard her whisper,
But I can't bear for you to think. I mean, what happened wasn't... I mean, I couldn't help what happened.
His hand left the doorknob.
Then it must have been somebody you loved.
Yes.
She was crying.
Well, dang it, why didn't you marry him? Good gosh almighty, Miss Love, are you saying you got mixed up with a married man?
It still wasn't my fault, but I thought you didn't care.
I don't.
Living a lie like I done, I ain't got no call to throw no stones. I ain't asking are you pure, but I know I can't stand it if you're going to hold a married man up in front of me like a picture for the rest of my life, saying I got to look at you and him. I ain't your Mr. Texas, but I can't take it if you're going to dish out little bitty hints about it every time your conscience starts to hurt. That'd keep me wondering and maybe jealous. God Almighty, Miss Love, forget all that, and just let me love you and make you happy. His whispered voice was angry. Why'd you have to raise this up from the dead anyhow? You going to put the past on and wear it like sackcloth and ashes the rest of your days? Miss Love was crying.
Please, Mr. Blakesley, be fair. This wouldn't have come up if you had let me stay what I agreed to be, just your housekeeper.
Grandpa left the room before Miss Love finished the word housekeeper. Came out and shut the door. I knew by the harsh breathing that he was furious. On the other side of the door, Miss Love lay down on the cot and muffled her crying in the pillow. I didn't see how in the world Grandpa could walk out on her like that. He started to pace the floor, but the boards creaked, and I reckon he was scared he'd wake me up. Shivering, he jerked his spiffy new suit coat off the back of the chair, put it around him, and stood at the window in the moonlight, trying to get a hold of himself. Every minute or so, he'd scratch his head like he had cooties worse than Hosey Roach. I must have dozed off, but I waked with a start when he turned the doorknob by my head and went back in there. I reckon Miss Love was too tired to get up. She whispered, "Go on to bed, Mr. Blakesley. There's nothing more to say. I'll deed back the house and leave Cold Sassy soon as I can arrange it. Then you can get an annulment and marry that other lady."
"What you talking about?" he whispered back. "What dang other lady?"
"You said there was one other woman in Cold Sassy you thought you could stand if I..."
"Oh, that. I just made her up. Like a good salesman makes up that somebody else is waiting with the money if and you don't take what he's selling. Miss Love, after all I done told you tonight, don't you know they ain't nobody in the world I want to live with except you? Doggett woman, I love you."
And then he went down on the cot with her and they were kissing again. At some point amid the sighs and moans and murmurs, Miss Love pulled away and whispered,
"It was my..."
Her voice was shaken, so I couldn't hear the words she said. Grandpa didn't either.
"What'd you say?"
"It was my father. My father. I said it was my father, Mr. Blakesley."
"You mean..."
He got up off the bed, and she did too.
"God almighty! Miss Love... You ain't got no call to tell me a thing like that."
She couldn't talk for crying.
"Shh," Grandpa whispered. "Shh, it don't matter now. Shh,
don't shush me. It does matter. And I'm going to stop crying and tell you everything. Sir, please don't say hush."
And she got a hold of herself and she talked. And she talked and talked, talked low and fast.
"No matter what you say, Mr. Blakesley, you won't want me for a wife. It's too awful. But I'm going to tell you. When I finish, maybe you'll pity me or maybe you'll be sick of me, but at least you'll know I couldn't help it. Maybe you won't be angry."
Her voice shook so at first that she was hard to understand, but she got out that it happened when she was 12 years old.
"You don't have to tell me, Miss Love," Grandpa protested.
"I do have to, so don't interrupt."
I doubted she remembered that I was just 2 feet away, and I forgot about trying to sound asleep, but they wouldn't have noticed if I'd started banging on the wall.
"We lived in 3 rooms upstairs in somebody's house. I had a little cot like this one in a small room next to what we used as a sitting room. Their bed was in the sitting room. Mama had heart trouble, Mr. Blakesley. Everybody knew she was dying, and the lady and man downstairs helped her all they could. They'd gone somewhere that night. I'm sure it wouldn't have happened if they'd been home. Well, I woke up when Father came in drunk as usual, and I heard Mama coughing and crying. She asked him for some water, but Mr. Blakesley, Father just laughed. Laughed."
"Don't, Miss Love."
She didn't hear him. Her voice had got mechanical, like she was reciting a story she'd read in the newspaper, one that didn't have anything to do with her.
"After Mama's coughing subsided, she said, 'Timothy, when I'm gone, you will take care of Love, won't you?' I'd heard her say that sort of thing many times, and it always made him mad. I just thought he never wanted her to talk about dying, as if it wouldn't happen if she didn't say the words.
But that night he suddenly screamed a man's name at her. "He's her daddy. Tell him to take care of her." There was an awful silence, and then Mama said, "Hush, Love might hear you. And you know it's not so, Timothy. He married somebody else, remember, years before I even met you." Father said that didn't prove a thing. He was so drunk, Mr. Blakesley. He cursed and said, "We were married exactly 1 week, Cleo, when you called me his name. I won't ever forget that." Mama said it didn't mean she'd been seeing him, but Father wasn't listening. He said, "You were carrying his baby. Admit it. Why else would you have married a man like me?" She was crying, but she got out something like, "God, help me. I didn't know what you were like, but as God is my witness, I was not pregnant." Father just laughed. "Why was she born in 8 months? Answer me that." He shouted at her like she was deaf. "She is his child, ain't she?"
"Hush up, Miss Love," Grandpa pleaded. "You don't have to."
"I have to." Mama was crying and went into the most awful fit of coughing, but he just cursed her. It was awful listening to them. Then I heard Father stagger towards my room, yelling, "By God, I'll show you what I think the truth is." As he came in where I was, he was still yelling at Mama. I'll never forget his words. "Would a man kill his own flesh and blood, Cleo?" I heard her scream, and I screamed. I tried to get under the cot, but he caught my arm. Then he said, "Aw, she's too pretty just to kill. Cleo, listen to me. Would I take my own daughter? No, by God. But by God, I can take another man's daughter." Miss Love's voice sunk to an awful whisper. "And then he raped me. Raped me, Mr. Blakesley. I tried to fight him off, but he..."
Grandpa must have started shaking her. "I hear you, Miss Love. Don't say that word again."
The whole time he was screaming, "You know what I'm doing in here, Cleo?" But she didn't answer. Finally he left, stumbled down the stairs and went away. When I got to Mama, she was on the floor in the hall unconscious. I held her for what seemed like hours. When the people who lived below came home, they got the doctor.
She sighed a long sigh.
Mama had been trying to get to me, but she passed out. We talked about it later, she and I. She said I had two choices. I could dwell on this the rest of my life, let it make me scared of everybody and bitter against Father, or I could forgive him and put my hand in God's and live my life. Something she said, well, I realized Mama didn't know he had... I realized she hadn't heard anything after he screamed, "Would a man kill his own flesh and blood?" So I never told her what really happened. She had suffered enough. But all the years after, I never forgot what she said about forgiving him. And I thought I had. I even got over feeling defiled, till I told Clayt and he did what he did. So, Mr. Blakesley, now you know. You don't have to wonder. Just accept that I was defiled and hate it, and I can never be anybody's wife. I don't even want to be a wife. I'll leave Cold Sassy as soon as I can.
Grandpa's voice was hoarse.
It don't make no difference, Miss Love.
I believed Mr. McAllister when he said that. Never again. Leave me alone, Mr. Blakesley. Go to bed and leave me alone.
Damn it, woman. Damn it, Where's your daddy now?
I don't know. Died drunk, probably. We never saw him again. He didn't come to Mama's funeral.
There was absolute silence in that room then, except they were both breathing hard. I thought sure Grandpa would try to comfort her, make her see how much he loved her, how nothing mattered now except to forget all that and let him take care of her. Maybe he would have, but she said to him in a voice cold as metal, "I said leave me alone." And he did. Grandpa stalked out, shut the door, and stood there by the bed shaking. I never saw him madder. I watched as he tiptoed over to the chest, raised the lid, pulled out a quilt, wrapped it around him. He stood by the window for the longest kind of a time, then knelt down by the windowsill and covered his face with his hand. Grandpa was crying, but he didn't make a sound except a hoarse gasp when he had to breathe. At some point I knew he had gone to praying. It must have been an hour or more before he came to bed. I don't think he slept at all. I know I didn't. Soon as I heard Miss Gussie in the kitchen, I bounced out of bed. "Better get up, Grandpa. Man from Athens might be here early.
Boy, howdy, I slept like a log. Hope I didn't root you, sir.
I wouldn't know, son. He looked like he'd been beat up, but he said he slept like the dead.
Reckon we better get Miss Love up? I asked. Without waiting for his answer, I called through the door. Miss Love, hate to wake you up, but that mechanic could be here any time now. We slept like the dead in here. We raring to go.
It was a nice breakfast with Miss Gussie and Mr. Nolly. Nobody would have guessed how mad Grandpa and Miss Love were at each other. The mechanic came at 7 o'clock. Soon as he fixed the radiator and cleaned the oil and grime off the engine, we took the Jamesons for a quick ride and then left Cushy Springs. If Grandpa had ridden home in the back seat with his arm around Miss Love, I'd have thought everything I heard was just a bad dream. But he rode up front with me. Chapter 42. Miss Love did a lot of horseback riding the next few weeks, and if she ever stopped to talk to anybody, I didn't hear about it. Whenever I went up there to clean the stable, I walked around the house, not through it. I didn't know what to say to her. Grandpa? Hearing him joke and tease and tell tales down at the store, you wouldn't have known he had a care in the world unless you studied his eyes. Since that night, they were never merry. And he started to look bushy again and older, and you could see his mean streak better. For instance, there was the matter of Mr. Clem Crummy having a drawing to get a new name for the Cold Sassy Hotel, recently bought from old Mr. Boop. After sprucing it up a little, Mr. Clem advertised a drawing in the paper for a name more befitting this fine, refurbished, modern establishment. The Crummies put a big shoebox on the hotel desk, and Cold Sassy filled it up with names like the Waldorf and the Savoy. Mama's entry was the Hotel Prince Edward. Mine was the Hotel Bedbug. Grandpa entered a name, but wouldn't say what it was. At 4 o'clock on Sunday, less than 2 weeks before Thanksgiving, Mr. Clem held his drawing on the hotel piazza. Nobody but him took it serious, but it was somewhere to go, so Cold Sassy went. Well, Miss Love didn't go. I remember that. When Mr. Clem pulled his fat hand out of the shoebox and looked at the piece of paper, seemed like he couldn't believe what he saw. I was just sure he'd drawn the hotel bedbug. But he hadn't. "For pity's sake, Rucker," he exploded. "If I'd have wanted a name like that, I'd have used my own." Then he commenced to laugh. "Folks, Rucker here done named my place after hisself. The Rucker Blakesley Hotel. Ain't he a card, though? I swanny, Rucker, you sure do know how to make a joke. Well, Miss Pauline, bring back the shoebox. I'll try again." While everybody laughed, Grandpa walked up so close to Mr. Clem they just about touched stomachs. "You done got you a name, Mr. Crummy. The Rucker Blakesley Hotel." The crowd got silent and uneasy. Mr. Clem looked like he didn't know what to say. "But ain't it just a joke?" "It was when I put it in the box," said Grandpa. "It was just going to be something to tell and laugh about, same as if you'd named it the Crummy Hotel. I never thought to get drawed." Though a smile was playing around under his mustache, his eyes were hard. "But now that it's the one, I kind of like the sound of it. You wanted a fine fancy name for your establishment? A symbol of success and character? Well, sir, seems to me like you got one." Looking back at me, Grandpa grinned.
You can't make me do that," Mr. Clem was sputtering. "It's my hotel."
"But it's my name." Grandpa put his forefinger on Mr. Crummy's big chest. "Your ad said you'd use whatever name got drawed. If and you don't carry out the drawing, I'll sue for breach of promise." "You can put Clem Crummy Proprietor on your sign if you got a mind to, but what it's going to be called is the Rucker Blakesley Hotel." Everybody thought Grandpa would take back the name after he'd had his fun. I knew he wouldn't. Like I said, he was not one to let go of a grudge, and several years back Mr. Clem had cheated him in a land deal. Well, now he'd got even. Got even and then some. But that didn't mean he wasn't still mad about it. The next evening, Grandpa came down sick. In a day or two, he was coughing and said he thought it was a relapse of lung disease from war deprivation. He said his symptoms were just like what went through the 6th Georgia one winter and sent word to the family that nobody was to come up there. "Rucker says it's catching a sin," Doc said. "I told Miss Love she better be careful. Boil his plate and fork and all. I don't want no epidemic getting started in this town." Mama was real worried. Not being sure Miss Love knew how to tend the sick, she took some chicken soup up there for him. Grandpa liked the soup but wouldn't let her in the house. She might catch what he had. Miss Love said he coughed and groaned a lot but was eating well.
I just don't understand it, she told Mama.
Something seemed fishy to me, but I couldn't put my finger on it. Maybe he was really sick. On the other hand, if Miss Love had started packing to leave, he might just be playing sick to keep her there. If she decided to stay but still refused to be his wife, maybe he was pouting. Or maybe he was heartsick, hating her for what her daddy did to her but still not willing to give her up. What I thought was that he loved her as much as ever and had decided to stay home till she gave in. I recalled him telling me one time, "When you don't know which way to turn, son, try something. Don't just do nothing." The one time I saw Miss Love during his confinement, she said, "He groans all the time, but he eats enough for a regiment. I don't know whether to laugh or cry, ignore him or worry." She must have decided to ignore him because after about 10 days, she got the idea of training Mr. Beautiful to old Jack's buggy. She'd hitch up and go off for hours. Grandpa soon let everybody know that the contagious period was over and insisted on going to ride with her. Said he was still weak, but the cold fresh air would be good for his lungs. After that, they were behind the horse every day, bundled up together under the automobile lap robes, her holding the reins and the whip, him sitting stiff and straight beside her. They would speak a greeting if they passed you, but as Miss Effie Bell said, it was like they didn't know each other or anybody else either. Before long, though, they were laughing and talking on their rides, and Grandpa was howdying and joking with everybody he saw. He had become the Grand Duke of Cold Sassy again. Like everybody else, Aunt Loma was relieved that her daddy was better. But tell the truth, she'd been too busy directing the school's Christmas play to worry much about him. Mama went over there one morning and found Loma sitting at the kitchen table writing on a tablet. She didn't seem to care that there were dust devils under the beds or that it was time for Uncle Camp to come to dinner. She said she had to work on the play. I expect it was the first time she'd been happy since she got married. Just before school let out every day, she'd bring Campbell Jr. down to our house, hand him over to Queenie, and prance off to direct rehearsals like she got a call to do it from God Almighty himself. Aunt Loma didn't make me be in the play, but anything she needed she called on me and got so bossy I couldn't stand it hardly. 2 weeks before play night, she told me to catch her a live mouse for Claude Wiggins to drop out of a shoebox in the third act. The mouse was supposed to create pandemonium at a Christmas party on stage. I think now that if Aunt Loma hadn't wanted the live mouse, it never would have dawned on me to mess up the play. The way it happened, my cousin Doodle and Uncle Skinny came in from their farm in Banks County about 3 o'clock one Sunday evening to spend the night with us and pick up a wagon load of feed corn next morning at the store. Doodle and I had just gone out to the barn to pitch down hay for his mules, when in strolled Pink Predmore, Leroy Sleep, and Smiley Snodgrass. After a hard cold spell in late November, there's nothing like a nice warm day to make you restless. You just want to do something, for gosh sake. Lying in the warm sunshine in the hayloft, we tried to think up something, but didn't have any luck. We were all kind of irritable. Doodle, who had his head resting on a horse collar, raised up to spit a stream of tobacco juice over Smiley's head, and Smiley got mad as heck. "You better be glad none of that landed on me," he said, growling. Doodle leaned over in the other direction and spat through the hay hole. Looking down below, he aimed next at the big barrel down there. "Damn," he muttered, "I missed it. Hey, Will, ain't that the barrel with them drowned rats your daddy said to bury?" "Gosh, yeah." I'd forgotten about it. Climbing down from the loft, we all went and looked at the 3 big stinking rats floating in the barrel amongst the ears of corn that had been the bait. Everybody knows that when a barn rat looks down into a barrel that seems half full of shucked corn, he never suspicions that it's really half full of water. By the time he finds out, he's trapped. He can't climb up the rounded sides. "Gosh, look how white they are," said Pink, poking one with a corn cob. "How come brown rats bleach out in the water?" Leroy had a thought that made him shudder. "You reckon colored folks turn white like that if they drown?" "Where you suppose the color goes?" asked Smiley. "I reckon it just dissolves," said I, gathering up the rats on a pitchfork. "Doodle, get that shovel over yonder here and help me dig a hole." Pink was suddenly inspired. "Whoa," he yelled, catching my arm. "Let's save the rats for Miss Loma, for the school play." "Haw, yeah," echoed Fat Leroy, clapping Pink on the back. "Can't you just see them rats dropping out of Claude's shoebox?" "Be mighty rank by then," said I. "School play's not till 2 weeks, you know."
but they knew by my wide grin that in my mind I was seeing stinking dead rats on Aunt Loma's stage. We hawed and guffawed, and then, I think because I'd taken off my shoes and it felt so warm and good and free with my bare toes twiddling in the dirt, it came to me that we should get Aunt Loma some live rats to keep her live mouse company. "We'll put shucked corn down in the barrel without any water," I explained as we went out to bury the dead. "We ought to be able to catch us a few by the night of the play." What we got was 19, collecting sometimes 2 or 3 a night. One looked big as a cat. Smiley found a large metal cage in his attic and brought it over. We padded it with hay and put it in an empty stall in our barn, hidden under some dirty old croaker sacks. On the day of the play, Leroy and Smiley backed out, put their tails down, and slunk right out from under the best practical joke ever thought up by man or boy in cold sassy Georgia. It really made me mad. Pink said maybe backing out was a good idea. "Well, you can back out, but I ain't." I was furious. If Pink didn't help me, there was no way I could get that heavy cage into the auditorium. "I'll stick with you, Will," he said, miserable. That night about first dark, he and I lifted the cage onto a wheelbarrow, covered it good with the croaker sacks, and wheeled it around the house through the pecan grove. Mary Toy was playing hopscotch in the yard and liked to have a fit to know what we had. "Something Aunt Loma wants for the play," I said, "but we can't tell anybody. It would spoil the surprise." As we humped the wheelbarrow over the railroad tracks, I looked back. Mary Toy was in the porch swing watching us. At the schoolhouse, we had a time toting the cage up the outside steps that led backstage. Dern! Leroy and Smiley could have at least stayed with it this far. There wasn't any real shortage of time, since Aunt Loma and everybody in the cast had gone home for early supper. We pushed the cage into a dark corner and tried to make it look like a natural part of the junk stored back there. Set an old globe on top of the croaker sacks and some cracked slates they kept for mill children to use, and 2 or 3 old window shade maps of Europe that wouldn't let up and down anymore. In front of it all, we put 2 scuttles of dusty coal and a faded half-furled Confederate flag, saved last year when Cold Sassy's old wooden schoolhouse burned down. We had a brand new brick school now and a brand new Confederate flag out there on the stage. Aunt Loma's Christmas play was sure to have a packed crowd because it would be the first entertainment held there at night, and everybody was anxious to see the electric lighting. Carbon bulbs were so dim that nobody thought you could light a stage that way. Aunt Loma had told Chap Cheney she'd kill him if he didn't get the stage wired in time for the play. With her telling him exactly how she wanted it, he had wired for dozens of bulbs to be screwed into the floor at what she called stage front, and other bulbs dangled from the ceiling. Aunt Loma had put up a lot of mirrors on the walls of the set, which gave her twice as much light for the same number of bulbs. That night, when the heavy curtains parted to show the lit stage, the crowd yelled and clapped till Chap Cheney stood up, grinning, and took a bow. The stage lights reflected on faces in the auditorium all the way to the back row, where I could see Papa and Mama and Mary Toy sitting with Uncle Camp, him holding the baby. I had a front row aisle seat, Pink right behind me. Smiley and Leroy sat primly with their folks, acting like they didn't even know us. Among the latecomers hurrying in were Grandpa and Miss Love. She was dolled up like a Christmas tree in a red velvet skirt, a red and white striped waist, and a red velvet hat trimmed in real holly. She seemed a little subdued, but Grandpa was greeting everybody. This was their first time at a public function since he took sick. He still hadn't gone back to work, but I thought he never looked haler or heartier or neater or spiffier. I sure was glad he got his health back in time for my rat joke. Just after the curtains opened, Aunt Loma marched in from backstage, dressed fit to kill in black silk and importance, and sat down in the aisle seat that the Tuttles had saved for her. I sat calm enough through the first act. But when Act Two started, my mind floated up to the stage and, like a ghost, went through the painted set into the dark corner where we'd hidden the rats. I sure hoped they hadn't got to fighting or squealing back there. Just like I planned it, when the auditorium went dark for Act Three, Pink and I slipped through a door by the stage and tiptoed back where the rats were. During the Christmas party scene, with all the actors singing carols at the top of their lungs, we dragged the cage to the wings and waited till Claude Wiggins created pandemonium by dropping the live mouse out of the shoebox. Soon as the mouse hit the floor, we opened the cage and shoved it onto the stage. Those big rats poured out of there like a house of fire. Talk about pandemonium. We had it on stage and behind stage and all over that school auditorium. You never heard such screaming and hollering. When the rats started leaping off into the audience, men were hitting out with their hats and walking canes, women were jumping this way and that or standing on their seats, some of which were breaking, and good gosh, everybody was trying to get out of there. I saw the rat that looked big as a cat dive off the stage right into Aunt Loma's lap. She knocked him off, but then just sat there, too shocked to move. I looked at Miss Love. Perched up on the back of her seat, she was shrieking with laughter, her red skirt bunched up nearly to her garters. Grandpa was laughing so hard he hurt, rocking back and forth in his seat, grabbing his stomach, slapping his leg, flopping his arms, and shouting like somebody getting religion at a camp meeting. When his left arm went up, it looked like the knotted empty sleeve was dancing. A rat must have jumped over Grandpa's foot because he kicked out suddenly, but I expect he was laughing too hard to make contact. To say we broke up the play was putting it mildly. The lights came on just as I peeped farther around the curtain and saw Aunt Loma trying to push through the crowd to get to our folks. She stumbled along, crying, her hands over her face like somebody had beat her. When I glanced toward the back of the auditorium, that brought me down some. I knew Mama and Papa hadn't a doubt who'd done it. They sat there just stunned, till all of a sudden Mama grabbed Mary Toy and they jumped up on their seats. By then the audience was crowding all the exits, shoving to get out. A lady screamed and Pink and I bolted for the backstage door. The live mouse and a rat or two scrambled out into the cold night with us as Pink flew off in his direction and me in mine. I beat the folks home easy. Felt my way upstairs, groped for the light cord hanging near the foot of my bed, jerked the light on, put on my old long pants under my new ones, jerked the light off and waited. I couldn't help it. In a few minutes, I was rolling on the floor with laughter. Every little bit, I'd stop to listen for the front door to open and Papa to roar out, "Will you come here?" Then I'd think about Aunt Loma with that lap full of rat, or my mother jumping up on the seat, and it was like I was a gun fired off. Laughter exploded out of me and couldn't any more be stopped than a bullet. But laughing dies off pretty quick when you're by yourself, especially if it's way past your whipping and your folks still aren't home yet. I was kind of sorry I'd messed up Aunt Loma's Christmas play. Oh, well, heck, if it weren't for my rats, Cold Sassy wouldn't remember that darn play past New Year's. As it was, everybody in town would be talking about it for years to come. And heck, Aunt Loma could put it on again. It was still 10 days before school would let out for the holidays. I could help her. "Will Tweedy, boy, you come here, right now." Papa was shouting at me before he got in the house and had his belt off before my feet could drag me down the stairs. I got whipped good. The next day he made me go over to Aunt Loma's to say I was sorry. Except for telling her I was sorry about the bosom stories I made up, which didn't count since Aunt Loma wasn't mad, I had never apologized to anybody in my life. But for once I was soaked through with honest remorse, not for what I'd done, but for what it did to Aunt Loma. I found her in her bedroom upstairs, sitting in a rocking chair nursing Campbell Jr. Her eyelids were red and swollen. Trying not to rouse the baby, I whispered, "Aunt Loma, you ain't gonna believe it, but, I wish now I hadn't have done that about the rats. It was a real good play, and I mean, I'll help you if you want to put it on again next week. I wish... Something about her face plus having to whisper made me wind down. I don't know what I expected. Maybe just a shrug of her shoulders, acknowledging she heard what I said. I sure didn't expect her to smile at me. I guess I wanted her to say something noble, like, "I deserved it, Will. I've always treated you awful. The one that should be apologizing is myself." Maybe I hoped she would handle it like God. I mean, the Bible says if you tell God you're sincerely sorry, he puts his arms around you and forgives you. Well, Aunt Loma was not God that day by a long shot. What she said, keeping her voice down to a whispered scream because of the baby, was, "Don't you talk to me about doing it again next week, Will Tweedy. Just get out of my sight." She was shaking all over, tears of fury streaming down her flushed face. Naturally, Campbell Jr. stopped sucking and went to bawling. "Get out of my house," she yelled above his frightened wails. "I'll hate you till my dying day. Get out. Get out." With that, she leaped up, holding the baby tight, and slapped my face so hard I reeled backwards. I slammed the door to her room as I went out and kicked the cats that were asleep in a pile by the back door. My first thought was, I'll never say I'm sorry again as long as I live. My second thought was, if anybody ever says I'm sorry to me, I sure ain't gonna slap him or push him away. My third thought surprised me. I realized it felt good to be back on familiar ground with Aunt Loma.
Ever since that day we'd had such a good time laughing about the bosom stories, I hadn't quite known how to act around her. Last night I could hardly enjoy thinking about those rats flying off the stage for worrying about her crying. Well, if she was determined never to forgive me, I might as well enjoy hating her again. By the time I got home, I was whistling. After that, Aunt Loma stayed in a bad humor with everybody, especially Uncle Camp. Just for instance, the next Sunday, while she was helping Mama and Queenie take up dinner, Campbell Jr. fell all the way down our stairs. "I swanted to God, Campbell Williams," she yelled. "Looks like you could at least see after your own son when I'm in the kitchen." "I'm sorry, Loma, I'm sorry," he said as he picked up the screaming baby. "You sure are. You're just sorry," screeched Aunt Loma, snatching Campbell Jr. out of his arms. "That's the smartest thing you've said since the last time you said it." When she wasn't fussing about him seeming glad to bring home the bent cans and Weevilly rice and flour we couldn't sell at the store, she was complaining about his not having any get-up-and-go. "You could at least ask Pa for a raise." After Grandpa went back to work just before Christmas, Aunt Loma had the gall to go ask him herself to raise Camp's pay. Grandpa really blessed her out. "I don't even need Camp," he told her. "I sure can't afford to pay him no more than I already do." I don't know if Uncle Camp heard that, but I know he heard what was said a few hours later when Hosey Roach, the mill boy, came in to ask for a job. Hosey had washed himself and combed his hair and put on clean overalls, and I could tell Grandpa liked him. He even took Hosey back to the buggy shed to show him the cars. Hosey didn't get a job, but later Grandpa told Papa he sure wished he could have hired that boy. "He'd be equal to three at Camp." At first I thought Grandpa didn't know Uncle Camp was standing right behind him, but maybe he did know and said it anyhow, hoping it would make Camp work harder. The very next Saturday, Camp got some get-up-and-go and went, and the way he did it made my rat thing seem about like putting a frog in somebody's bed. Aunt Loma never forgave him either. Chapter 43. Uncle Camp got away from Aunt Loma while she was gone to Athens. She had caught the train that Saturday morning, wearing a black wool dress and the big hat with ostrich plumes that Miss Love had made. She was to spend the day with her LaGrange college roommate, Sue Lee Gresham, who was now Mrs. Humphrey Wright of Athens. Uncle Camp had gone to work early that day, and since Papa thought any lady taking a train should have somebody see her off, he told me to drive Aunt Loma to the depot. To my mind, she didn't need a ride any more than if she was going downtown, which she did every day, and besides, she was leaving Campbell Jr. with Mama and Queenie. And naturally, I wasn't too crazy about being by myself with her. She might take the occasion to raise Cain about the Christmas play. But Papa said to, so I went and got her. She was far from friendly, but her mind was on Athens, not mere rats. Aunt Loma really didn't want to go, so she said as we waited at the depot. "Sue Lee's just using me as an excuse to have a luncheon. She hopes I'll be jealous of her. She's always writing about her big house and her big dinner parties and her husband being president of the bank. I don't call inheriting a bank from your daddy any proof that you're smarter than the next fella." Aunt Loma stepped back from the tracks as the train came in sight. "I just wish I hadn't told her I'd come." I always thought ladies liked to be honor guests at a luncheon and said so. "Besides, ain't nobody making you go." "Camp made me," she said, real irritable. "Well, I be dog." Chalk went up for old Camp. "He promised to fix the faucet in the bathtub if I'd just get out of his way. Said he couldn't tackle the job with me standing there watching him fail." Poor old Camp. Papa said afterwards that Camp actually applied himself that morning at the store. Instead of waiting around to be told what to do, he put in a real good morning's work. And whereas he usually had about as much life in his eyes as a turtle, he seemed almost happy. He and my daddy left together at dinner time. On the way out the door, Camp asked Papa would he mind stopping by the house before going back to the store after dinner. Kind of apologetic, like he hated to take up Papa's time, he explained. "I'm fixing to fix a leaky faucet, Mr. Hoyt, and I ain't never done one. I'd sure feel better if you'd come see that I do it right. Well, you know how Loma is." Papa did stop by, though grudging. I was with him. The door was open despite it was a cold day, and we went on in. "Camp," Papa called. "I'm in the kitchen, Mr. Hoyt. Come on back here." The shot rang out by the time Papa set foot in the dining room. Neighbors said they heard somebody scream. It must have been me or Papa one, though later I couldn't recall anything except the smell of gunpowder and
On the floor, a big long blob of blue and white checked oilcloth from the store. I didn't have to be told that Uncle Camp was under the oilcloth. He had laid down on a length of it, pulled one end up over him like a sheet and the other end down over his head and chest, and after calling Papa to come on back, had put the pistol in his mouth and pulled the trigger. I reckon he figured if all the blood and bits of bone and brains got trapped in the oilcloth, Loma Baby wouldn't be mad at him. Papa lifted the part that was over Camp's head, put it down quick, and turned away, his face like ashes. I had seen too. I stood there shaking. Finally, I said, "Papa want me to run get Doc Slaughter?" He could hardly speak. "Run get Mr. Birdsong, son." Mr. Birdsong offered me a ride up beside him in the driver's seat of the old horse-drawn hearse, the one he called an ambulance if the person wasn't dead. Since neighbors were already gathering, he drove the horses around to the back door, where my daddy was waiting. Papa had closed the kitchen door and hadn't let anybody go in there. Mr. Birdsong tied Uncle Camp up in that oilcloth like he was a dern sight of beef. Me and Papa helped carry him out and rode with him to the big old white-collared funeral parlor. Mr. and Mrs. Birdsong and their 9 children lived upstairs. Helping take Uncle Camp in there, I wondered how they could stand to live like that with dead bodies, especially when it was one that had committed suicide. Papa hurried home to tell Mama and sent me to the store to tell Grandpa and them, but they had already heard. As I ran in, Grandpa met me at the door, grim of face. He asked me a few questions, then stalked off to the funeral parlor. Soon as I could get away from the customers who pressed around asking more questions, I ran back to Aunt Loma's. I wanted to make sure there wasn't any blood or anything on the floor. If there was, Mrs. Brown next door had cleaned it up. But I could still see Uncle Camp, same as if he was laying right there with his brains blowed out, and it made me sick. I felt about to faint. Leaving the kitchen, I rushed past the people whispering in the hall and went to the bathroom. I nearly stumbled over the plumbing tools. Uncle Camp had left them on the floor by the tub. Just what you'd expect, Camp not putting up his tools. Then I saw a piece of paper stuck under the big wrench. I knew it was for Aunt Loma, but horses couldn't have kept me from reading it. "You can get the creeps, I tell you, reading what a dead man has just written. This is what it said. Loma, baby, I tried to plan so as not to mess up your kitchen. I loved you since the day I laid eyes on you. You just as pretty now as then. So it ain't you, Loma, baby. It's I ain't good for nothing, which you know. It's got so just getting out of bed every morning is too much. I packed up my clothes and all in a box so you wouldn't have to fool with it. My leaving this world don't have nothing to do with you being mad at me for not fixing the faucet. I've been aiming to do it a long time before the faucet went to leaking. Please save my gold pocket watch for Campbell Jr. I leave it to him. I aired it from my granddaddy, you know. I love you and always will, but now you can have some peace. Tell Mr. Blakesley I appreciate him giving me the job like he'd done. Now he can find him somebody who can do him a good day's work. I hope God will forgive me so I can meet you in heaven. Please don't be mad. I have planned it so you won't be the one to find me. Your loving husband, Campbell Williams. P.S. I fixed the faucet. P.S. I want to be Barrett and Cold Sassy so you can visit me sometime. Your loving husband, Campbell Williams. The page blurred. I wish so bad I could have known Uncle Camp for the past 3 years like I knew him now that he was dead. But even as I stood there holding his sweet and lonely words, I heard water going drip, drip, drip into the bathtub. I picked up the wrench and changed the washer. Nobody was going to say Campbell Williams was so sorry that he couldn't even fix a faucet. It was a small thing to do for somebody brave enough to put a pistol in his mouth and shoot. Chapter 44. Along with half the town, my family met the late train from Athens. Grandpa said later the folks just came to see how Loma would take the news, but I don't know. It seemed to me that going to the depot was the only way they could think of to show her they were sorry poor Camp had gone to hell so young. Camp having committed suicide and not living long enough afterwards to ask God to forgive him, there was no way he could ever be reunited with Loma or Campbell Jr. in paradise. Naturally, we all thought there would just be a quick private burying. Cold Sassy certainly never expected Camp would be brought home to lie in state. But he was. By first dark, Aunt Loma's little house was filling up with folks who had brought food and were waiting to speak to the new widow before settling in to eat. Loma was still upstairs in her room when here came Uncle Camp in a fine golden oak coffin with metal handles, riding in style in Mr. Birdsong's fine new glass-sided gilt-trimmed black hearse drawn by two black horses with black plumes on their heads. As soon as the horses stopped, Mr. Birdsong got down from the driver's seat, went in the house, and asked everybody to leave the parlor. Then he and his three sons carried in the coffin, escorted by my grandfather. His grimness forbade any comment as he stalked across the yard behind the coffin. Those watching looked shocked, like it was as awful for Camp to be brought home like a regular corpse as for him to have shot himself in the first place.